Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we scan weird and wonderful science digitized into your ears. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, we continue to explore the Singularity University Australia Summit booths. I try on a virtual reality Tesla suit and get my brain scanned in the field. But first, here's news of hyperstealth invisibility. Invisibility genius. Canadian inventor Guy Kremer of Hyperstealth has adapted a 100-year-old material into an invisibility cloak, solar amplifier, 3D projector, and laser multiplier. There's not enough space to cover these in detail until January, but here's a quick overview of the invisibility cloak. You know those 3D images with a plastic grid that change as you move? You often see the moving ones at Halloween, on trading cards, and those 3D pictures in some restaurants. You can run your fingernail along the ridges and they squeak. The ridges are half cylinders that act as lots of lenses. They direct reflected light from different stereographic images behind the plastic to each eye, giving you an illusion of 3D without special glasses. Or they show you one image from one angle that when you move, makes it look like the image has moved when you look at it from a different angle. Guy Kremer took that clear sheet of lenticular lenses and instead of putting an image behind it, he put it upright. He calculated the angles that light would be refracted by the many lenses and found that there was a dead spot a little way behind the lenticular sheet that the light rays completely missed. He realised that if you put an object in the dead spot, the light rays would miss it, making it invisible. He's since travelled around to the world's military, demonstrating his work. And he's got a whole lot of videos on YouTube. At first you can see there's a blur behind the screen, so it's not great invisibility, something's there. However, he then started changing things by adding a second sheet aligned with the first, and the blur resolved into the details behind the screen, except for the object you're hiding. In the videos, he demonstrates with a toy tank and with a big sheet with handles like a riot shield to hide a human. With the second version of the screen, it looks like you're looking through a window to see what's behind it, but completely missing the person or tank or model behind the screen. He explained that it's still blurry in this version because of the quality of off-the-shelf lenticular lenses, and that when he deliberately manufactures better lenses for this purpose, they should become very clear. He has versions where the shield is curved around the object you're hiding, like a cylinder, and others where it's only curved into a C shape. And either way, you can't see what's in the dead spot. He has versions where instead of a central zone of invisibility, the dead spots hide targets on the left and right edges of the sheet. He's managed to give one version a negative refractive index, which we've previously only seen with metamaterials made with microscopic precision. Even with the quick and rough versions in the videos, it's obvious that the military will lap this up, and it will have endless other uses as it's perfected. Lenticular sheets are easily available from wholesalers online, so this sounds like a great optics experiment for schools to play with. You won't get to the same level of invisibility as Guy Kremer, but you can still get rough invisibility. Enough to be worth playing with. I know I'll be ordering some lenticular sheets to try it out. I'll put a link to the HyperStealth videos on the webpage. I'll go into more detail of HyperStealth's patented invisibility shield and explain their solar amplifier, 3D projector and laser multiplier next month. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. What if you could feel in virtual reality? Dmitry Mikulchik is a co-founder of Tesla Suit, who make a skin-tight suit that has sensor and feedback electrodes built in to immerse you in virtual reality. I tried one on and went for a walk in virtual reality weapons practice firing ranges, throwing grenades and firing guns. I passed by a device that had cold fog streaming out and felt a mild tingle that was nothing like a breeze, but felt like something. Dmitry has been working on the Tesla suit for the last 4 years. I began by asking Dmitry, where did the idea come from?
The idea came about in 2014, so 6 years back, and we've done some research before establishing a company in London, UK. From there, the six of us took the project to the point where we are now 150 people, three offices, opening another base in the US, in Houston, sometime early next year. This year we were quite productive. We won 3 different awards. So we've won a Red Dot Design Award in the category of Best of the Best Product of the Year. And this one was a very prestigious award for, they actually look not only at the external design, fashion design, but also utilitarian part. So how useful is this for the humanity and where can it be used? And the use cases are many. We just started with lower hanging fruits, applying it to enterprise training, applying it to health and safety training. And now we're progressing towards more of a pro sports, pro athlete training and medical field. So we're running an extended research with medical rehabilitation centers across the world. We work with NYC, we work with Karolinska University in, I think it's Denmark. We have a collaboration in Far East Federal University that does post-neurosurgery rehabilitation and is the most, one of the best known places for that, for back injuries, surgeries. And we're very successful in that research. So every university has recognized how much potential there is, and we are progressing in leaps and bumps. So very soon we will be applying for certification for specific rehabilitation types.
And so the suit is basically like a wetsuit with a shirt and pants, and it's got how many sensors?
Yes, the suit comes in 2 pieces. It's based on sports materials, so it's very comfortable to wear and easy to put on and take it off. It has over 100 sensors at the moment. We run multiple different technologies, so the sensors sometimes are actually dubbing. We use the same sensors for input and output, which is very interesting. So in essence, it creates a two-way communication tool where we can pull the body and output stuff to the body itself, so the body actually participates in our tasks that we're putting the person through.
And so you're reading information from the muscles and the location, and so you've got a little figure on the screen that replicates everything the person does so they can interact in virtual reality, but you've also got feedback so you can feel things.
That's right. We built a what's called haptic feedback system. And haptics means everything to do with touch. So if the object is touching our skin, we would be able to feel that. So the digital environment obviously lacks the form and sensations. Incidentally, we bring that back. So everything that could happen to the person in real life can be replicated in VR or AR, you name it.
Fantastic. So it's complete immersion.
That's right. Yes, that's what we're aiming for.
And you're using a similar system to the physiotherapy TENS, electrical stimulation of muscles.
That's right. We have 2 systems. So one is TENS, transcutaneous neural stimulation, and that takes care of our nervous system. and a stimulation of that. But we also have electromuscular stimulation. So the muscle tissue needs to be exercised as well in certain cases, and that's what the rehabilitation field is looking forward to. Essentially, we can help people train both the reflexes, speaking to the brain via the neurons that we have, and at the same time, we replicate the signals. So to tell the muscle to contract, literally copying the signal from the brain, but we apply to the specific muscular group. So that would be very useful for those who lost mobility due to an accident or a stroke or some other incident.
So people who are paralyzed could actually exercise their legs or whatever they can't move by the suit sending the signals to move it for them.
Not only that, yes, they would be able to exercise in a natural way. We would use their own muscular system to do that, to do so. Hence, reducing the atrophy of the muscles, reducing the atrophy of neurons, and at the same time, in a rehabilitation scenario, it also removes the strain on the joints. So the joints are not exercised whilst everything else is exercised. The joints are becoming mobile. And that is very essential within the rehabilitation environment because joints have a tendency to calcify. So there's a risk that it will stop moving altogether, and there's a risk of breaking one's hips or joints in arms and legs.
Sort of a use it or lose it principle.
Exactly. Unless you use it, you will lose it. And what's very interesting, the window to start exercising certain parts is very short, and especially in strokes rehabilitation and post-stroke rehabilitation, it is important to start it from literally day one or day two. We provide the tools for the doctors to easily draw this specific mode in which the person would be rehabilitated, and then we can let the person go home and continue that rehabilitation, which actually frees up the doctor's time. Good doctor can trace and track multiple rehabilitees, so that makes the whole rehabilitation process so much easier and cheaper for our government.
So you can get people to exercise and move limbs that they otherwise couldn't move. Do you think with future development that you might be able to help people walk that otherwise wouldn't be able to?
We're working on a case. Can't divulge into the details of that, but yes, in essence, we'd love to see people stand up and walk. However, the Tesla will not be able to accomplish all of that. We collaborate with other technology companies to exactly accomplish that. But yeah, essentially that was the dream before when we looked at the rehabilitation scenarios. We always wanted to let people live their normal lives the way they did it before, you know, and enable them to come back to society. We're very pleased to visit Australia, all the way from London, UK. It's been very nice. The weather is very receptive, so we had good meetings. It would be nice to have people contact us should they wish to develop with us, co-develop and look at other cases that we haven't thought about, and we're always open to collaboration.
So how do people find Tesla Suits?
It's very easy. The website is teslasuit.io. We have a form at the bottom of the site, and through that form we can communicate, and we'll always come back and follow up on this.
Well, Dimitri, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That was Dimitri Mikhalchik from Tesla Suit. You can find more online at teslasuit.io. Brains in trouble. Professor Chris Levi is a neurologist and clinical academic at Hunter New England Health, Hunter Medical Research Institute, and the University of New South Wales in Sydney. He does clinical research into translating medical discoveries into treatment for strokes and systems of care that enable those therapies to be delivered more effectively and efficiently. A stroke is when blood supply in the brain is interrupted by a blockage or by burst blood vessels bleeding into the brain. Strokes injure your brain and may cause weakness, loss of sensation, or difficulty with speaking, seeing, or walking. It's important they're diagnosed as quickly as possible because the longer the brain goes without being treated, the worse the injury from the stroke. Professor Levi was at the Singularity University Australia Summit to talk about his work on using an invention from the Chalmers University of Technology in Gothenburg in Sweden to diagnose stroke victims in the field instead of having to wait until they finally get to a giant scanner in a hospital. I began by asking Chris, how do we diagnose stroke?
So stroke is both a clinical diagnosis, so everyone in the community can recognize stroke by remembering the FAST rule, face, arm, speech, FAS, if there's impairment in the face, in movement of the arm, or loss of speech. Then the T stands for time, because speed is very important then in mobilising the first responders, the ambulance service, and then having that passage rapidly to a stroke care centre where treatments can be delivered. But stroke is a major burden of disease. There's a stroke every 10 minutes in Australia. So it is important the community are aware. But in hospital at the moment, the cornerstone of diagnosis is brain scanning with either CT or MRI. However, of course, that requires someone to get to hospital, and the delays in arriving in hospital at times can be quite substantial, particularly in regional and rural settings. So being able to diagnose and scan the brain in the field would be a major advance in terms of what could be potentially delivered and processes speeded up. And that's where this innovation comes in.
And so how do you scan in the field? It's normally an enormous torus of very powerful magnets.
That's right. Well, this exactly is the challenge. And there are mobile stroke units that do actually have CT scanners in the back of trucks. So that is an innovation that is relevant and is being tested around the world. Mostly that is only relevant to large, dense populations, such as major capital cities, where a mobile stroke unit can be cost-effective in delivering care. However, almost half the population of Australia and many other countries around the world are dispersed in smaller towns and cities, outer metropolitan areas as well. So this innovation actually uses microwave technology to provide a form of image of the brain. And microwave technology can be miniaturised. It obviously exists in our phones. And in fact, the innovation that is a Swedish invention was derived from the microwave technological advances in the telephone industry in Gothenburg, where Nokia had a major presence. Chalmers University of Technology in Gothenburg are the inventors, Professor Michael Pessin and his team. However, they approached us in Australia because of our esteem and our capability in stroke care and in stroke imaging. The Hunter has a very strong stroke imaging group, and we are known to the Swedes, and they asked us to work with them to help them validate this microwave technology against the standard technology of advanced CT scanning. So that work is ongoing, and the microwave technology, of course, would allow you to convert a 8,000 kilogram plus device such as a CT scanner to something that would be in the order of a kilogram's weight. So the prototype device that we are testing, you can lift with one hand, you can pop in the back of your car or in the back of an ambulance, and you can pop it on anyone, anywhere, essentially, and do a scan that provides you, we predict, with an answer as to whether this is a stroke, number one, because there are stroke mimics that can masquerade as strokes, and secondly, what sort of stroke it is based on a differentiation between the two key types of stroke. So that essentially is a blood clot stroke, where a blood clot blocks a blood vessel and part of the brain is starved of oxygen, and a bleeding stroke, where a vessel ruptures and that part of the brain is then damaged by expanding blood clot in the brain. So the scanner aims to tell us which of those it is, and then would potentially allow treatments to be delivered to the patient before they arrive in hospital. So the time, the speed factor, will potentially be significantly enhanced by being able to make that diagnosis in the field.
And the urgency, the time frame you've got to treat, what happens if you don't get to treat them in time?
Okay, well, unfortunately, I've been around long enough to have practiced stroke medicine in the pre-treatment era and now in the post-treatment era. And we've seen huge change in the past 20 years for our ability to reduce death and disability from stroke. In the pre-treatment era, we were able to provide patients with best possible care, and stroke units themselves were a very important part of that, where doctors and nurses and allied health work together and we can benefit the patients to some extent. But the introduction of firstly clot-busting treatment in the late 90s and then clot retrieval therapy, so-called endovascular therapies for stroke in 2014-15, revolutionised what we can do. So now there truly is some really powerful treatments that we can deliver. But the benefit for them, for those treatments, is significantly linked to time. So the earlier that you can deliver those treatments, the better it is. The benefits can be two or threefold higher in relative terms if you deliver treatments 2 or 3 hours earlier than later. So being able to identify in the field and then deploy treatments, or triage even faster, get people to centres more quickly based on knowledge of what's going on, really will benefit patients, I've no doubt about that.
How long do you think it'll be before these could be rolled out?
Well, look, the validation work that we're involved in collaboration with our colleagues in Sweden is going to take at least another 12 months for the in-hospital validation. We then need to do some field work with the device to look at the ambulance services, utility, feasibility, deployment of the device in the field. We're beginning that in parallel next year in the Hunter as a proof of concept test. But I think within that 2 to 3 year horizon, hopefully we'll have these devices deployed in the field and we'll be able to make use of them. There's still uncertainty about how accurate they are and whether we're going to be faced with issues around false positive or false negative diagnoses, which are really the focus of this research at the moment, to look at what our diagnostic accuracy really is. And there may be limitations, and this is why we've got to test the devices, but the innovation itself holds great promise. Well, I think in terms of the partnership that is involved in this, I would just like to say this is a unique partnership. Australia has great innovators and inventors and has a great reputation in that space. But we need to work, I think, as part of a global enterprise in many areas because we are a small country. And working with our colleagues in Europe has been fantastic. Working with our research institute in the Hunter, our health service in the Hunter, and now here I am sitting in Sydney with an opportunity to work with other partners here. So beyond the initial phase of the work, I hope to see this as a statewide initiative, a national initiative, and I think we are in the era of big consortia, big partnerships, and this is, I think, a good example of the benefits that come from working in those collaborative approaches.
Well, Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Professor Chris Levi from Hunter New England Health, Hunter Medical Research Institute, and the University of New South Wales. As we sit here in the first week of summer, after a month of watching the national disaster of giant bushfires sweeping across New South Wales and Queensland, and while Brisbane, Sydney and Canberra are choking under thick smoke and apocalyptic orange skies, it's well to remember the Prime Minister is on record saying this.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The Treasurer knows the rule on crops.
It's coal. It was dug up by men and women who work and live in the electorates of those who sit opposite. From the Hunter Valley, as the member for Hunter would know. It's coal that has ensured for over 100 years
the Deputy
that Australia
Prime Minister
has enjoyed an energy competitive advantage that has delivered prosperity to Australian businesses and has ensured that Australian industry has been able to remain competitive on a global market. Mr Speaker, those opposite have an ideological, pathological fear of coal. There's no word for coalophobia officially, Mr Speaker, but that's the malady that afflicts those opposite. But it's that malady, Mr Speaker, that is afflicting the jobs in the towns and the industries and indeed in this country because of their pathological, ideological opposition to coal being an important part of our sustainable and more certain energy future.
And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker, or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate the show on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolfe. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2NVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XXFM in Canberra, and my local station, 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolfe. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolfe. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.